lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bear.
Locally, the impetus for the organization of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation was this land grab that was ostensibly under the pretext of forest protection. When you pay people to stop practicing their traditional agriculture, within a generation, they lose the ability to practice their traditional agriculture. When you pay to protect the forest, it sets in motion a whole number of potentially abusive, corrupt, and corrosive practices. Yeah, and the money is a problem on many levels, but as Gustavo Castro, who's one of the people I interviewed in Chiapas, he's the director of a small NGO called Otros Mundos in Chiapas, he says when a natural function like forest respiration becomes a product with a price, it's easy to see who's going to end up with control of the forests. Most of the intact forests in the world are inhabited by indigenous peoples, and it's no coincidence.
You're listening to episode 690 of Unwelcome Guests. Paying to cut. Paying not to cut. The unbearable costs of financialization. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard World Bank critic Jeff Conant on their policy of reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, the so-called RED scheme. The logic behind that is simple. If we don't like the consequences of paying people for cutting down trees, how about trying the opposite, paying people not to cut down trees? Well, we shall hear from Jeff Conant in a few minutes why that is something of a false choice, but to clarify that the points made about financialization in this show apply not only to forests or other so-called natural resources, but go much deeper. Who better but John Taylor Gatto? This is Lynn Gerry from episode 361, reading from his Underground History of American Education.
As it turned out, my own period of behaviorist training came back to haunt me 30 years later as garlic sausage eaten after midnight returns the next afternoon to avenge being chewed. In 1989, to my delight, I secured a substantial cash grant from a small foundation to pay kids for what heretofore they had been doing in my class for free. Does that sound like a good idea to you? I guess it did to me, I'm ashamed to say. Wouldn't you imagine that after 28 years of increasingly successful classroom practice, I might have known better? But then, if we were perfect, who would eat garlic sausage after midnight? The great irony is that after a long teaching career, I had always made a major point of instruction to actively teach disrespect for bribes and grades. I never gave gold stars. I never gave overt praise, because I believe without question that learning is its own reward. Nothing ever happened in my experience with kids to change my mind about that. Soaping kids, as street children called it then, always struck me as a nasty, self-serving tactic. Addicting people to praise as a motivator puts them on a slippery slope toward a lifetime of fear and exploitation, always looking for some expert to approve of them. Let me set the stage for the abandonment of my own principles. Take a large sum of money, which for dramatic purposes I converted into $50 and $100 bills. Add the money to a limited number of kids, many of them dirt poor, some having never eaten off a tablecloth, one who was living on the street in an abandoned car. None of the victims had much experience with pocket money beyond a dollar or two. Is this the classic capitalist tension out of which a sawbuck or a C note should produce beautiful music? Now overlook my supercilious characterization. See the kids beneath their shabby clothing and rude manners as quick, intelligent beings, more aware of connections than any child development theory knows how to explain. Here were kids already doing prodigies of real intellectual work, Not what the curriculum manual called for, of course, but what I, in my willful outlaw way, had set out for them. The Board of Education saw a roomful of ghetto kids, but I knew better, having decided years before that the bell curve was an instrument of deceit, one rich with subtleties, some of them unfathomable, but propaganda all the same. So there I was with all this money, accountable to nobody for its use but myself. Plenty for everyone, how to spend it. Using all the lore acquired long ago at Columbia's psychology department, I set up reinforcement schedules to hook the kids to cash, beginning continuously, paying off at every try, then changing to periodic schedules after the victim was in the net, and finally shifting to aperiodic reinforcements so the learning would dig deep and last. From thorough personal familiarity with each kid and a data bank to boot, I had no doubt that the activities I selected would be intrinsically interesting anyway, so the financial incentives would only intensify student interest. What a surprise I got. Instead of becoming a model experiment proving the power of market incentives, disaster occurred. Quality in work dropped noticeably. Interest lessened markedly. In everything but the money, that is. And yet even enthusiasm for that tailed off after the first few payments. Greed remained, but delight disappeared. All this performance loss was accompanied by the growth of disturbing personal behavior. Kids who once liked each other now tried to sabotage each other's work. The only rational reason I could conceive for this was an unconscious attempt to keep the pool of available cash as large as possible. Nor was that the end of the strange behavior the addition of cash incentives caused in my classes. Now kids began to do as little as possible to achieve a payout where they once had striven for a standard of excellence. Large zones of deceptive practice appeared, to the degree that I could no longer trust data presented, because it was so frequently made out of whole cloth. Like Margaret Mead's South Sea Sexual Fantasies, E.L. Burt's fabulous imaginary twin data, Dr. Kinsey's bogus sexual statistics, or Sigmund Freud's counterfeit narratives of hysteria and dream, like the amazing discovery of the mysterious bone which led to the, quote, proof of Piltdown Man, having been discovered by none other than Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who, after the fraud was exploded, refused to discuss his lucky find ever again. My children, it seemed, were able to discern how the academic game is played, or perhaps more accurately, they figured out the professional game, which is about fame and fortune, much more than any service to mankind. The little entrepreneurs were telling me what they thought I wanted to hear. In other unnerving trends, losers began to peach on winners, reporting their friends had cheated through falsification of data or otherwise had unfairly acquired prizes. Suddenly I was faced with an epidemic of kids ratting on each other. One day I just got sick of it. I confessed to following an animal training program in launching the incentives. Then I inventoried the remaining money, still thousands of dollars, and passed it out in equal shares at the top of the second floor stairs facing Amsterdam Avenue. I instructed the kids to sneak out the back door one at a time to avoid detection, then run like the wind with their loot until they got home. How they spent their unearned money was no business of mine, I told them. But from that day forward, there would be no rewards as long as I was their teacher. So ended my own brief romance with empty child pedagogy.
And if you're a new listener to the show, or if you just fancy a refresher course, John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, a decade or so in the making, I consider to be something of a masterpiece. So it's available for download from unwelcomeguests.net/audiobooks, either as one large file or chapter by chapter, if you just fancy dipping in. Now, we continue with the full interview of Jeff Conant. This is from September 2011, and it's by C.S. Soong of Against the Grain Radio.
In basic terms, emissions of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are bad. Trees, which remove carbon from the atmosphere, are good. So if we discourage deforestation, we can do a lot to combat climate change. Now, someone somewhere got the bright idea of actually paying communities and others who would otherwise cut down trees not to cut. And now everyone from environmental organizations to the UN to the World Bank to the state of California is lining up behind a policy called RED, under which financial incentives are offered to leave forests untouched. Sounds sensible enough, even wise. But according to my guest today, a careful, nuanced examination into the way RED reads and works leads to a very different conclusion. Jeff Conant has taken as his case study what might be called Zapatista territory, a part of southern Mexico from which the Zapatista Army of National Liberation emerged. Conant has written a series of articles about climate legislation, the RED policy, and the on-the-ground effects of schemes that incentivize the maintenance and protection of forests. Jeff Conant's latest book is A Poetics of Resistance, The Revolutionary Public Relations of the Zapatista Insurgency, published by AK Press. When I spoke with him in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I asked him how quickly forests are disappearing.
According to the United Nations, we are losing about 13 million hectares of forest annually, a hectare being an acre and a half. We've lost about 50% of the forests in the world or more that have ever existed. In regards to climate change, forests, of course, absorb carbon dioxide. So losing forests isn't just a question of losing biodiversity and losing livelihood. It's also a question of losing the ability to absorb all of the chemical mess that we've put into the atmosphere.
And you mention in your articles both tropical deforestation and forest degradation. So those are kind of two overlapping, interrelated things, but kind of separate.
Yeah, well, degradation is a technical term for when less than 10% of a forest remains intact. So deforestation means essentially the forest is gone for all intents and purposes. Degradation, you can have the area of the forest still covered in trees, but it may be second growth, it may be third growth, it may be vastly reduced. So it means a tremendous loss in biodiversity, and it means the ecosystem is no longer able to restore itself.
One of your focuses is on the Lacandon jungle in southern Mexico, in southeastern Mexico, along the border with Guatemala. How much of that jungle has been lost to deforestation or degradation?
Well, the number that you see is about that about 10% of that jungle remains ecologically intact. That what that means, of course, is questionable, but it's a vast forest that crosses the border between the Guatemalan Petén and Chiapas. It's the northernmost tropical rainforest in the hemisphere, and it's been devastated over the last two centuries by logging, by mining, by oil development, by cattle more than anything, actually, and by plantation agriculture. And in fact, one of the very interesting things about the Lacandon is, of course, in the 1980s, during the violence in Guatemala, Mexican national security policy dictated that the area along the border be deforested. So the Mexican government put money, backed by the World Bank, actually put money into logging and into cattle ranching specifically in order to deforest the area along the Guatemala-Chiapas border so that guerrilla armies couldn't find refuge there. So there's a long history of government policies actually deforesting, which is part of why it's ironic now that they're coming up with these Baroque Byzantine policies to protect the forest that's left.
What needs to be said about the level of biodiversity still remaining in the Lacandon?
It is the most biodiverse forest in Mexico. It's got the vast majority of the tropical tree species in Mexico, of the butterfly species, of the large mammal species. There are still jaguars, ocelots, tapirs, harpy eagles. Any number of endangered species still live in the small portion of the Lacandon that remains. One of the things that's notable about the Lacandon is, especially given its degradation, it's not that big in sheer area, but because it's a montane forest, meaning it goes from, I think, about 600 meters to about 3,000 meters above sea level, so it's got very rugged terrain, which means there's a lot of micro niches, a lot of micro environments. So there's tremendous biodiversity there. And in fact, that too is one of the concerns. There's been a long interest by pharmaceutical companies and by the so-called life sciences industry in inventorying the biodiversity in the Lacandon. And certainly folks on the ground in Chiapas believe that one of the pretexts for preserving the Lacandon is not just receiving payments for carbon sequestration, but also getting control of the forest in order to mine it for its biodiversity.
So you've already begun referring to a kind of new policy mechanism that's gaining steam. It's called RED, R-E-D-D, standing for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation. What kind of, in its basics, does RED call for?
This is a policy that's been on the table at the United Nations since about 2007, and in fact, it's one of the only policies that's being very strongly pushed in the United Nations climate summits. RED, or Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation, basically posits that forests are essential for mitigating the impacts of climate change because they absorb carbon dioxide. And in order to preserve forests, according to the methodology of RED, some kind of financial incentive needs to be put in place. The reason that forests have been destroyed rather than preserved for all these centuries is because it's far more lucrative to mine, to extract oil, to extract lumber, etc., than it is to actually preserve standing forests. So the idea is to make forests worth more standing up than cut down.
And so you have people who own or protect forests. And so under RED, what incentive are they given not to cut trees down, not to degrade their land?
The idea is that countries and even companies and industries in the global north would invest financial resources into countries and agencies in the global south to keep their forests standing, basically pay cash money to not chop the forest down. In exchange, those countries then are generating carbon credits, which can then be traded to companies in the global north to essentially continue polluting. And this is one of the big problems with RED. One of the basic problems being that you're taking forests, which are a complex ecosystem and a kind of a commons and a dynamic natural environment, and you're turning it into a commodity. And so you're essentially limiting the meaning of what a forest is by paying for it. Another problem being that the people that actually own and control the forests are not the people that tend to protect the forests. So the money from RED will go to states, will go to corporations, and will flow back to the same corporations in allowing them to continue polluting in the global north.
So the guardians of a forest, say in Mexico, they, under this scheme, would get a certain amount of cash money and also carbon credits that they would then sell or trade to polluters in other countries?
Exactly.
Well, RED, this policy mechanism, has been gaining a lot of steam, and we'll certainly talk more about RED and its application to specific communities. But what kind of support has RED gotten from official sources, from environmental organizations, that kind of thing?
At the last United Nations Climate Summit in Cancun, Robert Zoellick, the president of the World Bank, gave a high-level event on RED, which featured Robert Zoellick, Jane Goodall, Conservation International, the presidents and heads of state of many countries. And Robert Zoellick received rousing applause when he said that RED is the best chance and perhaps the last chance to save the world's forests. Now, sitting there and listening to that, I'm hearing it not as a forest protection scheme, but as a forest protection racket. This is, you know, the World Bank, the leading investor in fossil fuel development and in global environmental destruction, saying, you know, it would be a shame if something happened to the rest of the world's forests, so put them under our control and we'll protect them for you, essentially. So the World Bank has a project called the Global Forest Carbon Facility, which is dedicated to promoting RED. In fact, BP, the oil company responsible for the Gulf spill, was the first investor in the World Bank's Forest Carbon Facility. So the World Bank is there. You have the United Nations, of course, and then you have a whole list of market-minded conservation or environmental organizations from Conservation International, Environmental Defense, the Nature Conservancy, Natural Resources Defense Council, all of the environmental organizations that tend to believe that the market can get us out of the environmental and social mess that we've gotten ourselves into. One of the big challenges with RED is that it looks good. You know, if you don't have a really profound, I think, analysis of human rights and ecological concerns, the notion of paying to protect the world's forests, a lot of well-intentioned people, a lot of, you know, liberal, even progressive NGOs tend to go for it, which is part of why I've been doing the work and a lot of other, you know, organizations and people have been doing the work of digging up the details, because the devil is really in the details. When you pay to protect the forest, it sets in motion a whole number of potentially abusive, corrupt, and corrosive practices. But as it stands now, RED is being referred to as the only game in town in terms of forest protection.
How engaged has the state of California been to this RED mechanism, again, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation? How engaged has this state been with that concept, with that practice, and how attractive is it to the state's leaders?
California is actually at the forefront of the Global RED initiative. The way I like to tell the story, I was at the United Nations Climate Summit in Cancun last November and December, and I went to this event on RED that I mentioned with the World Bank and all of these other agencies, and Linda Adams, the head of California EPA, was there along with the president of Pacific Gas and Electric, and they were sitting on stage with Juan Sabines, the governor of the state of Chiapas in Mexico, and they announced that California was engaging in what they called the world's leading mandated RED initiative. Back in November of last year, Governor Schwarzenegger, as one of his last acts in office, signed an agreement with the state of Chiapas in Mexico and the state of Acre in Brazil to engage in a RED-type forest carbon trading agreement. And in the months since then, there's been a number of legal challenges to that. There have been a lot of kerfuffle, basically, about AB 32, the California's Global Warming Solutions Act. It's under this act, AB 32, California's Global Warming Solutions Act, which intends to reduce California's emissions by, to 1990 levels, by 2020. One of the ways that AB 32 intends to do this is through cap and trade, also known as carbon offsetting. And one of the ways in which that will be implemented is through RED. So specifically, California corporations mandated to reduce their emissions through AB 32 are only going to be mandated to reduce their emissions on paper. They're not going to necessarily have to reduce the actual amount that they're polluting, because they're going to be able to buy carbon credits from places like Chiapas and Acre, and also from within California. So this applies within California as well, where California's forests are also going into the carbon market.
And so this is what carbon trading is about, correct? If a polluter cannot or won't reduce its emissions to government mandated levels, then they can buy credits from another polluter, or in this case, maybe a community, and thereby they're purchasing the right to pollute above certain levels, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. They call it the cheapest way to reduce emissions, which is why it's so popular among industry. In fact, it doesn't reduce emissions, which is why it's so popular among industry.
Well, if it doesn't reduce emissions, why is cap and trade even on the table as a possible solution to the climate change crisis? I mean, isn't the whole regulatory and governmental effort to try and actually reduce the total amount of greenhouse gases being emitted?
You would think so. In fact, the Kyoto Protocol has been in effect for well over a decade now, and emissions have gone up. I mean, the European carbon market, which is the only active carbon market in the world, has managed to create a situation where European emissions have gone up. There's more climate pollution, more greenhouse gases being emitted than there was before cap and trade was mandated for the EU. So on paper, it seems to, I mean, it's a trick. It's what we call a false solution. I mean, the very basis of it, reducing emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. In 1990, we said that emissions needed to be reduced by 80% to avoid, you know, spiraling climate chaos. And industry and government spent a decade lobbying to reduce that mandate. They reduced it to an absurd level, and then they're implementing cap and trade and these other false solutions, which are essentially ways of allowing business as usual to continue.
Well, you would think, Jeff, that a scheme that's supposedly about paying folks to protect their forests from extraction, that the word forest, the term forest, would be important to the meaning of the regulation, the policy. How is forest defined in the RED policy, and what maybe alarm bells does it raise?
Yeah, that's a great question, because in fact, one of the problems with RED is that the United Nations definition of forests includes monoculture plantations, it includes genetically engineered trees, and it includes secondary and tertiary forests. So within the RED scheme and within these kind of global forest carbon schemes, you hear terms like enhanced forest carbon stocks, which means replanting forests with species that absorb a lot of carbon from the atmosphere, which may include eucalyptus, it may include African palm, which is used for biofuels. So the very understanding of what a forest is part of the issue here.
And money is a big issue. So if RED requires the granting of financial incentives, where is the money coming from? Who will pay the guardians of these forests?
Yeah, and the money is a problem on many levels. But as Gustavo Castro, who's one of the people I interviewed in Chiapas, he's the director of a small NGO called Otros Mundos in Chiapas, he says when a natural function like forest respiration becomes a product with a price, it's easy to see who's going to end up with control of the forests. Most of the intact forests in the world are inhabited by indigenous peoples, and it's no coincidence that the forests that remain intact are on indigenous peoples' lands. It's because they have not, you know, given the choice, they don't destroy those forests. Those forests tend to be remote, they tend to be difficult to access, and there tends to be all kinds of resistance to industry entering those forests. When you put an economic value on those forests, you create a situation where all kinds of predatory interests come into play. So if that forest was up till now not worth paying attention to by Chevron, by ExxonMobil, by American Electric Power, suddenly there's money in that forest. There are dollar signs on those trees, and it becomes much more interesting. Another issue is that most of the indigenous people who manage and live in these forests do not have legal title to their land. So if you are giving money to the people or agencies that control these forests, it tends to not be the people who live in the forests. What does that do? It marginalizes and excludes, and in many cases, and this is what I saw in Chiapas, actually evicts people from their forests. On the other end, here in California, for example, the money for RED will come from carbon offsets. So, you know, as we've said, what this does is it allows industries in the north to continue polluting. Say, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, will invest in, or the state will invest for them through subsidies in protecting forests in the south. Those forests will generate carbon credits that then come back to PG&E. So what happens then is, again, the communities most impacted, folks in Richmond and Kettleman City and Wilmington, in West Oakland, you know, in all of California's most polluted areas, fence line and frontline communities are the people most impacted by both by climate change and by point source pollution. These kinds of carbon offset projects virtually ensure that those people will continue being impacted by pollution, will not receive any of the economic benefits, will not receive any of the climate mitigation benefits while industry continues to pollute.
So you visited not too long ago a Mayan peasant farmer village in the Lacandon jungle. I think it had something like 1,500 people. That was its population. Tell us about that community and the degree to which they value the jungle and the forest around them.
The village is called Amador Hernandez, and it's inside the Montes Azules Biosphere Reserve in the Lacandon jungle in Chiapas. Essentially, before we went there, before they would take us in, they said, you know, we understand that you're looking into this policy that we don't really understand much about. We think it has something to do with what we're experiencing. And I said, you know, well, what is it that you're experiencing? And they said that about a year ago, all of their medical services had been cut off, and they weren't exactly sure why, but they felt that it had to do with interest in their land and their forest. Now, Amador Hernandez, like all of the remaining communities within the Montes Azules Biosphere Reserve in Chiapas, they don't have title to their land. They're indigenous Tzeltal Mayans who have lived on this land for generations. They may not be originally from there, from that precise spot. One of the, like everywhere on the globe, you know, one of the interesting things in the Lacandon is lots of in-migration, lots of out-migration. So these people, actually, the people of Amador Hernandez, were for centuries, were serfs in the timber camps on the plantations. And many of them, as I was told the story, escaped forced labor, basically, a handful of generations ago and founded this community of Amador Hernandez. It was after the community was founded, in 1971, the Montes Azules Biosphere Reserve was created around them. So essentially, they may not be originally from there, from that precise spot. One of the, like everywhere on the globe, you know, one of the interesting things in the Lacandon is lots of in-migration, lots of out-migration. So these people, actually, the people of Amador Hernandez, were for centuries, were serfs in the timber camps on the plantations. And many of them, as I was told the story, escaped forced labor, basically, a handful of generations ago and founded this community of Amador Hernandez. It was after the community was founded, in 1971, the Montes Azules Biosphere Reserve was created around them. So essentially, a border of a natural protected area was drawn around the place where these, you know, these folks already lived. And for the decades since then, they've had a battle to hold on to their land, and there's been a battle between the government of Chiapas and the federal government of Mexico to formally delineate that border, which they call La Brecha Lacandona, the Lacandon Gap, or the Lacandon border. So for many generations now, the government has been trying to quote-unquote protect this land, which means evicting illegal settlers and what they call regularizing the land there. The folks in Amador Hernandez felt that their medical services had been taken away because they'd been getting notices for a few years that La Brecha Lacandona, the Lacandon border, was going to be drawn right through their community, and they were being asked to leave, essentially, with nowhere to go. So they refused to negotiate with the government. At a certain point, about a year ago, the government stopped providing them with vaccinations, stopped providing them with any kind of medical services. There had been a service of what they called aerial caravans. Amador Hernandez is 15 kilometers from the nearest road. So the government had been providing monthly evacuation flights to bring out people who were fatally ill. Those suddenly stopped. And all of this looks to them, and certainly looks to me, like a way of starving them of services in order to push them off their land. They're one of 11 communities that are left within that area. A dozen or more villages have already been resettled from that area.
So there's an effort to delineate this boundary. There has been involuntary displacement of communities and villages. Again, we are talking in part about a new policy initiative called RED, Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation, under which financial incentives would be given to forested communities or people or entities that hold title or own, in some sense, forests, not to deforest that land. So how does RED enter into what the people of Amador Hernandez have been experiencing?
Essentially, in order to generate financial incentives under RED, you need to measure the amount of carbon dioxide that a forest can sequester or can hold. In order to do that, you need to conduct what they call a forest inventory. You need to count the trees within a given area. In order to do that, you need to define the area. So what's happening in the Lacandon, and this is happening, I mean, it's worth saying, this is happening everywhere in the world right now. It's a massive global program. But what's happening in the Lacandon is that the area of the Montes Azules Biosphere Reserve and what's called the Lacandon community are basically, there's a border that's being drawn around them in order to be able to take the final measurement of the land area and then the number of trees, the number of tree species, the size of the trees, in order to come up with a calculation of how much carbon that area can store in order to then put a price tag on that carbon. Of course, that price tag fluctuates according to the market. So a community like Amador Hernandez lives within the forest. They depend on the forest both in terms of producing their food, producing their medicines, producing their fibers, their thatch, their fodder, the whole thing. In fact, when we went into Amador Hernandez, they were holding a medicinal plant workshop to continue building, one, because their medical services had been cut off and now they're entirely reliant on botanical medicines, but two, as a way of demonstrating for us who were visiting the ways in which they rely on the forest for medicine. Of course, this is true everywhere in the world. But because they rely on the forest for medicine, because they cut, they do what is very pejoratively and dangerously called slash and burn agriculture. It's that name was given to it as a way of denigrating peasant farming. It's Sweden agriculture or shifting agriculture. Essentially, they plant in the forest, and these kinds of activities are considered to cause degradation, to cause deforestation. And so in order to maintain an intact forest and in order to measure the amount of carbon the forest can sequester, those people need to go. So they're considered illegal, they're considered irregular, they're considered destructores was the word that they kept saying that they'd been called, forest destroyers. In fact, it's, a very small community of peasant farmers who are working with hand tools. And down the road, you have timber companies, you have oil companies, you have mining companies, you have several big dams that are planned for the Usumacinta, a nearby river. So the very last people that should be held responsible for the destruction of this forest are the peasant farmer communities who now have no place to go and no resort. So Amador Hernandez is facing eviction, and they took a very brave stance. I've written about them now in several articles, and they made a community decision. We went to a community assembly that they invited us to, and the collective of the village essentially decided to put their name out there and put their political position out there. I mean, they're in an incredibly vulnerable position, but they said, we are the last community that is going to be standing up against this policy. So we're going to put ourselves out there and we're going to denounce it in order to stay where we are, in order to continue living on our land.
Well, at least some of the landholders in the Lacandon jungle in Chiapas, Mexico, are getting money. They're getting about, or they're said to be getting about, the equivalent of $200 a month from the government of Chiapas. They must like that.
Yeah, well, that's, who doesn't like getting free money? And that's, again, part of the problem is, let's see, in the state of Chiapas, there are officially seven ethnic indigenous groups, and one of them, the Lacandon people, has been for the last several decades sort of treated as what they call los indios auténticos, the authentic Indians. they continue to wear their traditional dress. They continue to practice what appear to be their traditional rituals, some of their traditional practices, living deep, what was deep in the Lacandon jungle. While many of the other indigenous ethnicities of Chiapas, Choles, Toholobal, Tzeltal, Tzotzil, were subjected for generations to serfdom, you know, were forced to work on the haciendas, were forced to submit to all of the, the violence and indignities of the conquest. Because the Lacandon people lived deep in the forest, they were able to maintain some of their original identity when they were discovered in the so-called discovered in the 1950s by a European anthropologist called Trudy Blom. And what happened then was she engaged all of the mechanisms of the anthropology of the time. The idea was to assimilate them immediately. We found these remote, impoverished indigenous people. We need to bring them services. We need to, you know, we need to bring them into the state, essentially. And then the missionaries come in. So within 2 decades, the Lacandon people are Catholic and they're dependent on commodity foods and, you know, the rest of the story that we're familiar with throughout the world. In the early 1970s, the government of Mexico makes a deal with the Lacandon people. We will give you 600,000 hectares of land to protect and preserve as long as you give us the timber and mineral rights. And this is called the Lacandon Community. In order for this deal to go down, something like 35,000 people from other indigenous ethnicities had to be forcibly removed from that area. And they settle in the marginal areas around the deepest part of the Lacandon. They form their own communities. They struggle for land tenure and land rights recognition from the government. They form peasant unions. And essentially, they fight back against the government for having expelled them. Several of the peasant unions that formed out of this expulsion became the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. This is part of what's fascinating about the story, is that the Zapatistas, from a global perspective, we talk about them as having risen up due to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is true. But in fact, locally, the impetus for the organization of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation was this land grab that was ostensibly under the pretext of forest protection. So the Lacandon people are given 600,000 hectares. Most of the other indigenous people in the region are forced off of their land. Because of this, that 600,000 hectares was never able to be actually delimited or measured. And now under RED, that area needs to be delimited, the forest needs to be inventoried, the amount of carbon that it can store needs to be measured. In order to do that, the government of Chiapas is now paying the Lacandon people 2,000 pesos a month, the equivalent of about $200 US, to, one, not plant their traditional crops, not practice, you know, what they call slash and burn or swidden agriculture, and two, to protect the forest from invaders, meaning all of the neighboring people. And while I was in Chiapas, I talked to several Lacandon people who said, yeah, we are receiving this money and we're, you know, we're quite happy about it. The government is paying us to protect the forest. The people, the Lacandon people who are receiving this money are only the landholders. There are about 60 families who are receiving the money. The women are not receiving the money. The children are not receiving the money. The money right now is coming from a state tax. How sustainable that is a question. The governor of Chiapas basically said, we are paying them to preserve the forest in anticipation of international funding and funding from the state of California to come through. If that money doesn't come through, who knows what's going to happen. When you pay people to stop practicing their traditional agriculture, within a generation, they lose the ability to practice their traditional agriculture. And we are talking about the people that, you know, that invented corn. People who have been farming on this land for millennia. In fact, it's a policy in the state of Chiapas right now to criminalize the milpa, as they say, to criminalize traditional agriculture and incentivize agrofuels or biofuels, incentivize coffee, incentivize all kinds of export-led agriculture, and de-incentivize traditional agricultural practices as if these practices are the root cause of the destruction of the forest.
What do you say to the argument, and I'm sure it's been made, that, well, other efforts to halt deforestation have come up empty, and so if this red policy, again, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, if this red policy has a chance of working and would thereby save at least some of the remaining forests around the world, we ought to try it.
That's the argument. I mean, a lot of well-meaning people, there are a lot of small organizations that promote RED that say, well, it may not be the best thing, but, you know, we've got to try it. Part of, well, some of the technical jargon within RED gives us some clues. In order for a RED project to be certified, it needs to be verifiable, permanent, and additional. And now this is jargon, but what it means is that the carbon that is sequestered by the forest needs to be verifiable. You need to be able to verify that X amount of tons of carbon have been sequestered by this forest that you did not cut down. In fact, it's never been verifiable. The Government Accountability Office says that carbon markets are subject to vast fluctuation, and there is no real authoritative way of measuring the amount of carbon that a forest can store. So it's inherently not verifiable. RED projects are supposed to ensure permanence, meaning that the carbon that is sequestered is supposed to be permanently sequestered. The problem there is that there's an inherent difference between forest carbon and fossil fuel-based carbon. The carbon that we release into the atmosphere from burning coal and from burning oil is carbon that has been sequestered in the earth for millions of years. And the carbon that is in forests is naturally non-permanent. Forests burn, forests die, forests, you know, shift. So there can be no such thing as permanent storage of carbon in a forest. Forests, by their very nature, are dynamic. So you cannot replace the carbon dioxide that's been released from a fossil fuel vein with the sequestration capacity of a forest. There's no such thing as permanence. Additional. RED projects are supposed to be additional, meaning that the forest needs to be on the chopping block anyway to get the money. If you have a forest that's been protected for millennia, a forest that's still standing where there is no danger of a dam going in, no danger of a lumber company coming in, no danger of a mine, because it's been so well protected by the local people, that forest is not actually eligible for RED funding, because you have to have additionality, meaning you have to prove that that forest would have been destroyed if this money had not been invested in it, which means that if you are a mining company, you want to buy up that forest and threaten to destroy it in order to receive the money. And it's in that sense that we say that it's not a protection scheme, it's a protection racket, because the money actually goes to those who would destroy the forest if they were not receiving the money. The other big issue that I feel we haven't touched on deeply enough is the question of human rights safeguards. RED projects increasingly, because of social movement pressure, need to have human rights safeguards, meaning, you know, we need to show that people won't be evicted from their lands when these projects go into place. But human rights safeguards have never worked. The World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, they all talk a good game about human rights safeguards, but they have never worked. And what I saw in Chiapas is that the government is talking about putting in place human rights safeguards once we've got RED off the ground. But getting RED off the ground means getting the indigenous people out of their forests. And, you know, once that happens, there's no human rights left to safeguard. So all of these are reasons why, you know, though the policy may sound good and may appear to be some kind of real forest protection option, the details are astonishingly ugly. What we talk about in the climate justice movement is ecological debt or climate debt. Yes, money needs to be raised to prevent industry from cutting down forests, to allow communities from cutting down their forests. But while RED is going into effect, we have the tar sands going in. You know, we have coal-fired power plants being built all over the country and all over the world. We have industry continuing to invest in fossil fuel development on the one hand, and to supposedly put money into forest protection on the other hand. It's an entirely false solution. And not only that, it's what we're seeing as a global land grab. Tom Goldtooth, who's the director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, frequently calls it possibly the greatest land grab of all time, because what you're doing is you're taking forests that have essentially, we've talked about the problem of land tenure and land ownership. In some sense, the fact that these lands are not officially owned is not a terrible thing. You know, for indigenous communities, the whole question of ownership is a moot point. So to take these forests and to put title on them, to commodify them, and then to put them into the market is essentially to assure their destruction. If not the destruction of the trees, the destruction of the forest as an integral ecosystem.
Well, getting back to California, and, you know, you mentioned the Global Warming Solutions Act, which was passed, I think, in 2006. And then you referred to Schwarzenegger just before he left office, creating this California Chiapas state-to-state cap-and-trade agreement that incorporated elements of this red scheme. The cap-and-trade elements of the bill, of the overall law, AB 32, were, in fact, challenged in court, correct?
Yep. Two organizations, the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, and Communities for a Better Environment, challenged the cap-and-trade provision of AB 32 in court this past March, and initially won. And then the California Air Resources Board appealed the decision, and just now, on August 24th, actually, there was a final hearing under which the California Air Resources Board said that cap and trade is the best way forward for California under AB 32, meaning that, the environmental justice communities in California launched this lawsuit against the cap and trade piece because it virtually assures, as I've said, that communities in California, frontline and fence line communities, will continue to be the dumping ground for industry because the industry does not have to actually reduce its pollution. They launched this lawsuit not to stop AB 32 itself. In fact, many of the provisions of AB 32 are very popular among the environmental justice community and among environmentalists more broadly, but to stop the cap and trade piece. This was appealed by industry and by the Air Resources Board, and as it stands now, it's going forward. The cap and trade is going forward, and the red piece of it, and this is a little bit complicated, but red will be implemented as part of the cap and trade provision of AB 32. It's expected to come online by 2015. So it's not actually in place right now. There's actually a team, a small group called the Red Offsets Working Group, that is developing the mechanisms by which red will work for California.
And I feel like I need to keep reminding listeners who just joined us that red is, again, it stands for the Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation Policy Mechanism, which basically proposes that governments, corporations, or forest owners in the Global South be given financial incentives for keeping their forests standing. Now, you make clear in the various articles you've written on this topic that groups, including the ones standing up to red, they do want, in fact, wealthy nations to come up with the money to protect and maintain forests. So if red is not the avenue for that kind of effort, what do they want to see?
We talk about reparations, climate debt, ecological debt. These are, in some sense, utopian solutions. The United States State Department is never going to go for giving back what it took, you know, what the U.S. has taken over the centuries. So it's kind of a difficult subject. But essentially, the financing that is being promoted right now for climate mitigation is predicated on offsets, and it is falling under the World Bank's Green Climate Fund, which is the fox guarding the hen house, essentially. What is needed is to eliminate the drivers of deforestation, to reduce industrial agriculture, to stop to keep the oil in the soil, to keep the sand in the land, and to keep the coal in the hole, as we say, you know, to find alternative solutions rather than building more loopholes. To think that global policies may emerge based on protection of indigenous peoples and based on climate debt, I mean, it's naive. That is not going to happen. But we need to continue fighting for some more realistic solution, some solution that actually addresses the drivers of climate change and the drivers of deforestation, and that doesn't criminalize and punish the people who are already the most marginalized and the most vulnerable.
Now, you've written that the offsets, the carbon offsets based RED scheme that's in the pipeline requires a stable and reliable carbon market. Does such a market exist?
The simple answer is no. I mean, the carbon market it's another balloon waiting to happen, another bubble waiting to happen. There is all kinds of investment in it, all kinds of investigation into making it work. But the European carbon market, as Friends of the Earth Europe said, has patently failed in two senses. One, emissions are higher than they've ever been. And two, in order for the carbon market to work, it needs to be cheaper to actually reduce emissions than to buy carbon credits. What's happened in Europe is that it's cheaper to buy credits than to reduce emissions. In other words, there's all kinds of cheap carbon credits floating around on the market that you as an industry, as a corporation, can buy, and that prevents you from needing to actually reduce your emissions. Like any market, it's volatile, it's liable to what they call gaming, it's liable to all kinds of corruption and fraud. So what we need is direct regulation of industry and direct protection of forests based on forests as inherently valuable and not by putting price tags on them.
And carbon trading, and this has been proven, it generates huge profits for people in the sort of carbon marketing business, right? The intermediaries.
Yeah, this is part of why, I mean, it's not going to go away anytime soon. It's generating billions for Goldman Sachs, for all of the same Wall Street criminals that have put so many people out of their homes across the country and across the world. It's another ballooning commodity market that will, in fact, make a number of people incredibly rich and make many more people go bust.
That's the voice of Jeff Conant. He is an author, a journalist, a veteran social justice activist who focuses on issues of ecology and international development. We've been talking about a series of articles he's written for publications like Earth Island Journal and Alternet. And you might want to check out his latest book, A Poetics of Resistance, The Revolutionary Public Relations of the Zapatista Insurgency. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, CS. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
And if you'd like more material in that vein, you can download it from againstthegrain.org. Now, in our second hour, we're going to have, first of all, a quick introduction to financialization, then a longer discussion with Max Haven about how the financialization process is undercutting our ideas about what it means to be human. But I'm going to try and expand the reach of this program, even to go beyond money. I'm going to read sections from an article called A Big Little Idea Called Legibility, which is a review of the book Seeing Like a State, How Certain Schemes to Improve the Human Condition Have Failed. The Authoritarian High Modernist Recipe for Failure. James Scott calls the thinking style behind the failure mode authoritarian high modernism, but as we'll see, the failure mode is not limited to the brief intellectual reign of high modernism, roughly the first half of the 20th century. Here's the recipe. Look at a complex and confusing reality, such as the social dynamics of an old city. Fail to understand all the subtleties of how the complex reality works. Attribute that failure to the irrationality of what you're looking at, rather than your own limitations. Come up with an idealized blank slate version of what reality ought to look like. Argue that the relative simplicity and platonic orderliness of the vision represents rationality. Use authoritarian power to impose that vision by demolishing the old reality if necessary. And watch your rational utopia fail horribly.